Politico is reporting that President-elect Donald Trump has tapped Stephen Miller, incoming senior White House policy advisor, to write Trump's upcoming inaugural address. Yesterday, another Miller, Jason Miller, no relation, surprised many by declining Trump's request that he be director of communications. And over the weekend, Trump's transition team issued a statement saying the president-elect would dissolve his charity, the Donald J. Trump Foundation, to avoid the appearance of any conflict of interest. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Robin.
Start with the announcement regarding the Trump Foundation. There had been so much scrutiny, including the use of charity dollars to settle lawsuits unrelated to the charity. The charity is also currently under investigation by New York's attorney general, who says technically Trump can't dissolve the organization while it's being investigated. So what's going on here?
There is going to be a great deal of continued investigation and journalism about this foundation. It appears to be a way that Donald Trump has done business. It has had people that it's done nice things for, but over the years, it's also had a number of other functions for Donald Trump. So it's going to be a source of conflict of interest, or at least accusations and allegations of conflict. And so it's best from the standpoint of the Trump White House to shut that foundation down.
Look, let's be clear. There are people who claim it really wasn't a charitable organization.
There have been such allegations because, in particular, they used foundation money to pay off fines with respect to a lawsuit down in Florida and in some other cases. They used money to buy some things that appeared to be of benefit to someone such as Donald Trump himself, for example, a portrait of himself. But it has been a source of a lot of black eyes for the campaign and now for the transition team. And they are saying the best way to deal with it is to just shut it down, at least temporarily.
Well, the day before, Trump's son Eric said he'd suspend his charitable foundation. This raises money for terminally ill children at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. And at that point, Trump tweeted, "My wonderful son Eric will no longer be allowed to raise money for children with cancer because of a possible conflict of interest with my presidency. Isn't this a ridiculous shame? He loves these kids, has raised millions of dollars for them." Explain why there was criticism of Eric Trump.
Eric Trump, of course, is still free to give money to St. Jude's or to any other cause that he wishes. But what he won't be able to do if this foundation does shut down is to run celebrity golf tournaments at Trump golf courses with the very close nuclear family arrangement by which Donald Trump and his children are going forward to run his business and also to some degree to run his political affairs. Any kind of a gift to any kind of a Trump foundation would be seen in general as being a way to potentially curry favor with the Trump administration in the White House.
Yeah. Ron, before we let you go, take up Israel. On Friday, we know the UN Security Council passed that resolution decrying Israeli settlements in the West Bank. The U.S. didn't veto it. They chose to abstain, though, which allowed the resolution to pass. And now Israel's president, Benjamin Netanyahu, is blaming President Obama, saying he's looking forward to working with the future administration. And Donald Trump tweeting, "As to the UN, things will be different after January 20th. How unusual is this? There are literally two voices leading America at this point.
That's right. And we have the president still in charge in the sense of setting policy for the time being. And you have world leaders, Vladimir Putin, Benjamin Netanyahu, also talking to both Donald Trump and to Barack Obama. Obviously, in those two cases, they prefer the prospect of Donald Trump and the relationship they expect to have with him after January 20th. Donald Trump has made it clear that he did not approve of the United States failing to veto that UN resolution, which passed unanimously on the Security Council with the United States abstaining. A parting shot, perhaps, from President Obama and a parting shot as well from Netanyahu.
Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and Washington desk correspondent. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, tomorrow, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will be the first Japanese leader to publicly visit the memorial to the December 7, 1941 attacks on Pearl Harbor, attacks that drew the U.S. into World War II. Abe will attend with President Obama. And what's more, public opinion in Japan is in favor of the trip, even though at the time of the attacks, most Japanese felt they were justification for the American-led oil embargo that was devastating the country as Japan increasingly attacked its neighbors. And for decades, many Japanese felt the U.S. attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki made them the bigger victims. Shihoko Goto is senior associate for Northeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. She joins us by Skype. Shihoko, Pearl Harbor gets just a few lines in school books. How is it taught?
It is seen as a attack that was a miscalculation on the part of the Japanese military, but it doesn't get as much space as what Japan had suffered since then. But that said, by Abe going to Pearl Harbor tomorrow, it really brings the U.S.-Japan relations when it comes to understanding history to a full circle. The Japanese will be looking at this very closely, not just in the body language as well as the verbal language that Abe will demonstrate, but also the U.S. reaction. How will the American media, the American public, and of course the American veterans respond to Abe's visit? And there is a lot of optimism. I want to add that when Obama visited Hiroshima in May of this year, Japanese public opinion was very favorable towards it, and the Japanese would certainly like that kind of reaction to Abe's visit tomorrow.
Well, it'll be interesting how widespread that response is. President-elect Donald Trump tweeted out after President Obama's visit to Hiroshima in May, "Does Obama discuss the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor while in Japan? Thousands of Americans' lives lost." In other words, he seemed to be responding in the way that many Japanese would have 10 years ago. You know, we can't talk about one without talking about the other. You're saying that now public opinion in Japan might have shifted a little bit because obviously people are favorable, even people on the far right, have been favorable of Abe's visit tomorrow.
Right. When it comes to Japan and its relationship with the United States under the Obama administration, the footing is clear. Japan remains the biggest Asian ally for the United States. When it comes to Japan's relations under a new administration, of course, Japan is not alone in this, there is a lot of uncertainty and there is a lot of concern. Abe was the first foreign government leader to meet with President-elect Trump after the U.S. elections. And the understanding of that bilateral meeting was that they seem to get on, and there is certainly hope that that kind of good personal relationship will be reflected in a bilateral governmental relationship.
This was the meeting that was also attended by Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, which on this side of the ocean, a lot of people, you know, raised a lot of eyebrows. But stay with the new president, because before he was elected, Donald Trump castigated Japan for not paying more for its own defense. He was critical of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, the trade deal. We understand that this visit to Pearl Harbor comes as Japan is spending a record amount of money, more than $40 billion on national defense, something that post-war, you know, Japan had completely pulled back on any defense spending, obviously the losing side after that war. Do you see a connection between Japan spending so aggressively on its military and a new president in the U.S.?
I don't think the Japanese government spending on military would have changed whether Hillary Clinton won or whether Trump had won. What is clear, though, is that the current Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is committed to building up Japan's own defense capabilities. As you pointed out, Trump himself has said that U.S. allies in Asia and beyond should pay more for the defense capabilities, and that is certainly something that is reflected by the Japanese government. There is a lot of public opposition in Japan, though, to that, because Japan still has a pacifist constitution. That pacifist constitution was, of course, written by the United States after Japan's defeat after World War II. Mm. But it has really been embraced by the Japanese public. And any move that may make Japan more militaristic has been very warily seen by the Japanese voters.
So as we said at the outset, many Japanese feel justified for the attack on Pearl Harbor, justification for an American-led oil embargo at the time on Japan as Japan attacked its neighbors. And then after the bombings on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, many Japanese felt vindicated, you know, because they became the bigger victims of the war. But this moment right now, President Abe going to the Pearl Harbor site, he has many ties to nationalist organizations. Is this something maybe of a Nixon in China moment that he might be the one that would be acceptable to nationalist groups to go?
I think it's clear to say that what he hopes to achieve here is to ensure that U.S.-Japan relations are strong in the future. And it wants to play the great statesman role in global politics. And that's really important as we move towards a new U.S. administration. There is concern that the United States may not be as engaged in Asia, and that in turn could elevate Japan's presence and leadership in the region. And that can only come unless Japan is able to really reflect on its past, to acknowledge its wrongdoings, and be accepted by other countries as a country that is prepared to take on responsibility and then move towards the future.
That's Shihoko Goto, Senior Associate for Northeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Shihoko, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And NPR will follow Abe and Obama's visit to Pearl Harbor tomorrow. 2016 has been a great year for author Nathan Hill. He published his debut novel, The Nix, N-I-X, after years of work, and the results, raves. The Nix topped Entertainment Weekly's list of the best books of the year. It made the New York Times and Washington Post's lists of notable books. Reviews compared Nathan Hill to John Irving. John Irving then compared him to Charles Dickens. Nathan and his main character Samuel have a lot in common. The real Nathan was a promising writer whose first book was lost when his computer was stolen in New York. Samuel, the character, is a writer who also can't finish his book for different reasons. They both become compulsive internet gamers. They both teach college. But then Nathan gives Samuel his own story. His mother abandons him at the age of 11. She becomes a hippie, ends up at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. But wait, the book also takes us inside a Humvee in the Iraq War, onto a boat in mythology-filled Norway. There are plagiarizing students and, what, Hubert Humphrey? We spoke with Nathan Hill in September as The Nix was just starting to take off. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do I understand it's about 600 pages now that it was 1,000?
It was 1,002 when I finished a first draft and gave it to a very unfortunate friend. I said, hey, I have this manuscript. Could you take a look at it? Before that, nobody had seen anything, any pages at all, except for my wife.
Well, and 9 years in writing it, but you say most of that was foundering around and trying to do research. Why? I mean, did you reach down a rabbit hole and then realize you didn't know that rabbit hole?
That's exactly right. I began with some material about this character who ended up being the mother, Faye, in the story. And I was trying to tell her story of what she went through when she kind of experienced the 1968 protests and riots at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And I realized that I really didn't know nearly enough about that subject, nor did I know what the plot of the story was going to be. So I spent long afternoons at the Chicago History Museum. I read every book that I could and just sort of floundered around for a while until I finally kind of pieced together a plot. And then once I did that, all of these other characters sort of started attaching themselves to it.
Right. And boy, there's so many. What of the strands did you know? Did you know about Norwegian mythology?
No, I didn't. My mother's side of the family came from Norway, you know, a few generations back and eventually became farmers in Iowa. And we've lost all touch to that part of the family. But I knew it was part of my history. And so when I would come across some of these great, you know, old Norwegian folktales, they would sort of stick in my head.
And so the Nix, N-I-X, is?
It's a spirit of the water that's usually depicted as a horrible, ugly, troll-type thing. But sometimes it will appear to children as a beautiful white horse, and it will try to tempt them to climb aboard. And if they do, it'll run them into the water and drown them.
Okay, charming.
Yeah. It's one of those great stories to tell, you know, like an 11-year-old.
Well, and there's a reason it's the title of your book, and we don't want to give too much away about how all of these disparate strands braid at the end of the book, but there are many parts of the book that you absolutely do know about. Samuel is a struggling writer. You are a struggling writer. You know, all this promise, very shiny in school, it seems, you know.
That's right. That's right.
And then suddenly you get to New York and splat. Can you read just a little bit of writing about your character, Samuel, now a frustrated professor with really bratty students, thinking back?
You bet. What Samuel thinks about in these moments is how he used to be a pretty big deal. When he was 24 years old, a magazine published one of his stories. And not just any magazine, but the magazine. They did a special on young writers. 5 under 25, they called it. The next generation of great American authors. And he was one of them. It was the first thing he ever published. It was the only thing he ever published, as it turned out.
Yeah. Reflect a little on that. You know, the guy who, you know, everybody told you were going to be a great writer, you were doing really well, and then you just could not get published.
When I came out of school, I was beginning to think of myself as a writer for the first time, you know, and I wanted to take the world by storm and convince my parents that I had made the right decision pursuing this career. And the writing I was doing was sort of careerist. Like, I was trying to write stories that would impress editors and agents to try to get lunches and try to get in the big magazines. And it was horrible. You know, as it turns out, when you try to impress people with your writing, you write really unimpressive prose.
How'd you change that? How do you not do that?
I stopped submitting. I stopped querying. And I stopped really worrying about my career. I stopped worrying about trying to fulfill this kind of fantasy of being a writer in New York. I actually left New York. And while I was writing this book, for the many years I was working on it, I didn't tell a soul about it, except for my wife. Mm-hmm. Instead of trying to write something that would help my career, instead I decided to write something that was just really idiosyncratically me. And that's what I worked on. And yeah. I hoped that people would like it. And as it turns out, some folks have been saying some really nice things. So it's gratifying.
Well, we should also say, too, that you were encouraged as a child. I mean, you loved writing as a child. Another thing that you give to your character is your love for the choose-your-own-adventure books. Mm. They were so big in the 80s and 90s. And there's a portion of your book where, for several chapters, we are told, if you want to go forward on the storyline, go forward to the next chapter. So there's a little homage there to choose-your-own-adventure books. But after that first crushing trip to New York, you also did something else. As your character does, you became a gamer. Were you as bad as the gamers you depict in the book?
No, I don't think not. I had to amp it up a bit for dramatic purposes in the book, but I did play a lot, like so much so that I had to. Yeah, you know, there would be times when I wouldn't be able to go out with friends because I had a raid to go on. I would say, you know, a good like 40 hours a week is probably pretty, you know, pretty reasonable. You know, gaming came along at a time in my life when, you know, all of my stuff had been stolen in New York, and a good friend of mine suggested we play this video game together, and mostly because he could keep an eye on me that way. You know, we could chat through the game. And he could just make sure I was okay. And
did it get that bad? Like, how morose might Nathan get?
Yeah, it was pretty depressing. I just moved to New York, and suddenly all of my books, all of my clothes, my computer with all of my writing in it, all of it was stolen in one moment, you know. And the great people that I worked with at the time put out a fund to try to just get me clothed, you know. So it wasn't a great time.
So play World of Warcraft.
It turns out it was quite effective, you know. Like, the rest of my life was sort of out of control. But I could be really good at this one thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was sort of emotionally analgesic for a while. But I realized after a couple years of playing, the reason that I had needed in the first place as an escape from the real world was exactly the reason I needed to quit.
So gaming makes its way into the book, as does the Democratic Convention, as we said, as does a Republican Convention in more recent times, publishing, publishers, ghostwriters, and Faye, always Faye kind of at the center of it. You're quick to have said that you immediately called your mother and said, Mom, I got something to tell you. I've got this book that's turning out to be a great thing. You are not Faye. You're not really mm-hmm. Faye. But how much did you turn to your mother or someone else's mother to find out about being a young girl in Iowa with a Norwegian father who doesn't want her to go to college because it's showing off? There's no contraception. Where did you find out about that?
Well, I had to tell my mom that Faye wasn't her, because Faye is quite a cold character, and my mom is a very supportive and warm person, mm-hmm. but they share the same biography. So whenever I was writing Faye and I needed some poignant mom detail, I would reach for my own life, for mm-hmm. her life. And so the town that Faye grows up in, the small Iowa River town, I modeled it after the town that my mom grew up in, Comanche, Iowa. Mm-hmm. And my dad grew up in nearby Clinton, Iowa, on a farm out there. And so I would visit that place in Iowa every summer. So I would pull from those memories when I was constructing the character. But of course, it's fiction, and the demands of fiction are such that you have to introduce yeah. certain elements that nobody would actually want to live through. So some of those things were just pure imagination.
So all these storylines are almost in serial form. Much like Dickens. I mean, did you think of that there?
I really wasn't. And hilariously, I did not think I was writing a long book when I was writing this long
book.
That
is hilarious.
Yeah. I really, when I finally had a rough outline of what I thought I might do, and this was about 2008, I really thought it was going to be 300 to 400 pages. But other things kept glomming onto it. You know, yeah. Laura, the cheating student, Pwnage, the video game addict. When these things felt thematically cohesive with other things I was doing in the book, I would allow them to stay. So it sort of swelled accidentally on me.
Boy, Laura, the cheating student. Whoa. I mean, you taught for a little while. Are they out there assuming that it's okay to cheat and everything's the professor's fault? And
they are out there. Yeah, I spent 9 or 10 years teaching college writing. And I should say that most students are wonderful and hardworking people. But there are enough Laura Potsdams out there that when my friends and I would talk about our jobs teaching college students, we would all have the same horror stories, you know? We all needed to use this software in order to catch people plagiarizing. And the students didn't seem to think there was anything wrong with it. If they could get away with it, they were right, you know?
Yeah. Well, so I always wondered what it would be like to sit across someone who is poised to be a major literary talent. This is what it looks like, a little bit of overnight beard growth. I mean, you've just started all this, your tours and your interviews. Is that a burden to have suddenly this great expectation of you?
I like what you did there. it's not a burden. I couldn't be happier. You know, I worked for this on this thing really hard for 10 years, and I with no guarantee that anybody would ever want to read it, so that it's getting such a kind reception. I'm over the moon about it. In terms of expectations, I have 2 decades of rejection under my belt, so that helps keep one grounded a little bit. And I also have some very good friends who've known me for a long time and are very good at keeping me humble. There was a picture of me that came out in the New York Times about a week ago where I'm wearing a black shirt. And very quickly, I had some friends texting me a caption contest. And one of them was, I think, Peter Pan Goes Goth was a highlight. Another one was Emo Elf Spotted in Park. So I have plenty of people in my life who are making sure my head doesn't get too big.
Yeah. Nathan Hill, his debut novel is The Nix. You'll see it in bookstore windows. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our conversation with Nathan Hill in September. Not too late to get The Nix for a holiday present. Well, I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. I know not everybody has got a body like you. But I gotta think twice before I give my heart away. And I know all the games you play because I play them too. Oh, he was born Georgios Kyriakos Panayiotou. He became George Michael, first with the hot pop group Wham, then in his own solo career, which debuted with the album Faith in 1987. He died Sunday at just 53. The BBC's Paul Gambaccini was a longtime friend. Paul's in New York right now. And Paul, George almost died in 2011 from pneumonia, but still, this must have been so shocking. Your thoughts?
I was very saddened. He had been ill in the past few years, but when you consider that I'd known him for his entire professional arc, beginning when he was 20, it's very sad to think that he could have done so much in such a relatively short period of time, and now it's over.
Yeah.
And we've lost a great musical star, but also a great human being. People don't realize that he was the leading secret philanthropist in popular music, and he would make gifts and require that as a condition you not tell anybody.
Huh.
And now some of these are coming out, quite extraordinary. He worked at a homeless shelter on the condition that people didn't say he was there. He once was watching Deal or No Deal on television, and a woman needed $25,000 in fertility treatment, and he called up and just gave it to her on the condition that it not be publicized. In my own case, I had to raise £300,000, which is $500,000, for Britain's leading AIDS charity, and he donated $80,000 anonymously.
Wouldn't let you tell anyone.
No. So that's the kind of person he was, very private in his generosity.
And Paul, just the music, with Wham first, you know, the pop star, then his own sound, just how would you define it?
He was certainly the leading British artist in the American charts in the 80s. He had 10 number ones in the United States, which is one of the 10 top totals of all time. And he did so with very honest and forthright music. When he was a young man, he had young concerns. Songs like Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. Wake me up before you go-go, cause I'm not planning on going solo. Wake me up before you go-go, take me dancing tonight. But But then when he became a young man, he had adult concerns. And then when he was older, and that's the title of one of his albums, he devoted his music to serious subject matter, such as the loss of his lover and of his mother.
Kindness in your eyes, I guess. You heard me cry, you smiled at me like Jesus to a child.
So you have an artist who reflected where he was in his life at the time.
A terrible loss in music. Paul Gamaccini, thank you so much for helping us note it.
Thank you, Robin.
George Michael died Sunday at 53. This is often called the giving season, but that part of the holidays may be lost on kids who are more focused on the getting. And that's normal, says Ron Lieber, author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. He says parents can give their kids and other children in their circle the gift of generosity. He outlined how in a recent Your Money column in the New York Times. Welcome, Ron. Happy holidays.
To you, too.
And it is the season. This year's opportunity to give charitable donations and get a deduction this year ends at the end of this week. But I'm imagining that's not the incentive you want people to teach kids.
No, I think we're all trying to imprint the value and the trait of generosity on any children in our orbit. And because this is the time of year when most grown-ups are thinking about it and doing it and giving money themselves, it's a great opportunity to start getting in the habit of talking about it with
right.
those kids.
Right. And giving for reasons other than your tax deduction. So let's get started. First of all, what age are you talking about to start talking to kids about philanthropy?
Oh, I think you can start as early as 3, 4, 5. You know, at that age, kids begin to become in tune with needs of other people around them, whether it's people that they know who may be suffering in some way, shape, or form, or strangers who they see on the street. They will begin to ask questions. Those questions will be uncomfortable, and we want to take our best shot at trying to answer them and making them feel better.
Right. Well, and you talk about you were having a conversation with your 8-year-old, and you were talking about donations and wondering, was there anything we left out? And there was. You know, they had an opinion.
We did start the conversation with our 8-year-old about how we give money in our household, and we wanted to share that information with her so that she understood how we were dividing our charitable budget. And it turns out that she saw something that was important to her that we had left out.
Her camp.
Exactly. She wanted to make sure if there were kids who were not able to afford to pay the tuition, that there would be money there for kids like that. Those kids would still be able to go.
Well, you say start with a family history of how the family's been helped. Talk more about that.
Sure. Every family has a history of having been helped somewhere along the way. My family's history includes me having been on financial aid in middle school and high school and college. My mother is a survivor of premenopausal breast cancer. My wife is the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors. All along the way, people have thrown the rope back for us. And so those are the stories that we tell to our older daughter so that she understands why we are moved to give ourselves.
And I was thinking, Ron, that this might be an especially important conversation in families that don't have a lot. Whatever you have, maybe there's a small amount you can have a child give so that there's less shame attached, you know, when they see that there are other people who need help in the way that family might be getting help, that will make them understand they're not the only ones.
I think that's true. You know, we're all part of a variety of communities, and in any and every way that we can attempt to cement that fact in our kids' hands that and our heads, that, you know, we're all reaching out our hands to help one another. I think the more opportunity we can take like that, the better.
Well, you also propose what you call a charitable pie. You touched on this a little bit, a family conversation where you literally, maybe even with a pie chart or a bunch of beans, you talk about how you're going to divide up money.
So here's how that starts, right? You sit down and you say, for every $100 that our family gives away, this is how we divide it. And you take 100 beans or 100 jelly beans, black beans, whatever you want to do. You divide them into piles and you say, okay, for every $100 we give away, you know, $22 goes to our church and another 13 goes to the school and 15 goes to the homeless shelter and 10 to the food bank. And once you start dividing those piles, you'll see by their size that they're a relatively good approximation of what your family seems to care about most. And if you don't like the size of the piles or if something's missing, then that ought to tell you something too.
And you change it. We're going to move on to finding a cause, which can be so much fun, different ways to do it. But how much do you tell people when you say give $100 away? I know kids whose eyes would fly open at that. What? We have $100 to give away? How much do you tell kids about what the family income is and what the money is?
Well, quite often the conversations about giving will lead to bigger questions about what you have and how you got it and how much is enough. And, you know, the younger kids, they're often not ready to deal with the bigger number, either because they don't have the math skills or they don't have the context about what it takes to run your household and its budget each month and each year. So the right answer to kids who are inquisitive about that is just to say that we have every intention, or I have every intention, of sharing that information with you one day, maybe late in your teenage years. But right now, you don't know enough about all of the things that we spend money on for that information to make any sense. But someday I'm going to tell you.
Okay. Then you go to finding a cause. Tick off some of the ways.
Well, quite often children, and increasingly younger children, will have a sort of burning desire to help someone or to do something for a group of people. And you can take that instinct and follow it to its logical conclusion by doing research about sort of cost-effective charities that are doing great work and having impact. But if you're sort of at a loss, one thing you might do is call your local community foundation and asking a program officer there for help. Often that program officer will take you on a tour and show you organizations and neighborhoods that are in need. But even if you're not, they may point you in a direction of organizations where your dollars could be put to good use.
Well, this might be a great eye-opener for kids to go actually see nonprofits at work. But as you write, you know, you got to be careful. This isn't poverty tourism. You know, they're not gawking at the other.
No, not at all. One reason to bring a professional into the conversation is to make sure that you are being respectful. But one great outcome that can come from visiting places is that you begin to establish relationships with people and organizations that will, you know, lead you to become not just a giver of money, but a giver of time and talent, a volunteer, who can help over many years and not just with a single check.
Yeah. Now, you list some of the different ways that people are trying to find places to give and trying to decide how to give. And one of them we're actually going to follow. This is the Brandeis School of San Francisco. It is a Jewish studies curriculum. And these kids collect money over the course of the year. So we're going to see what they do with their money in a couple months. But you can speak to your own school about doing something, or you can do something called a giving circle. Talk about that.
A giving circle is just a group of people that all decide to get together and give collectively by consensus. And so what many parents are doing with their kids is that they're helping organize giving circles for them. There's a group of Asian American kids in Texas who are doing this to try and fill some of the funding gaps in Asian American nonprofits. And there's a group of boys, actually, who are doing this here in New York City. Their parents thought it would be a good idea to do a single gender group, given the number of complications that can come up sometimes when there are mixed gender middle school groupings. So parents are finding ways to put this together on their own, even if their school doesn't have the wherewithal or the resources to do it themselves.
It doesn't have to be a lot. I mean, if kids get together and decide $25 between them, that's a lot to a kid.
Right. And it's a lot to a kid, but, you know, you can do it with grown-ups, too. You can make it part of your, dinner parties. You can make part of your New Year's Eve gathering. You can stop and talk about the things that are most important to you, and everybody throws $20 into a hat, and you draw lots, and, the person whose cause gets picked, the money all goes to that cause.
And maybe if you're going to do that as adults, include the kids, and then their money goes a little further. But, okay, so the last thing that you talk about is sharing this, because culturally, we don't like to talk about money. A lot of people keep this to themselves. You say no, share it, talk about it on social media, inspire other people. But when, and this is, we're talking about kids, you know, getting kids, your kids to do this. When are you sharing this great thing, and when are you bragging?
Well, it's a fine line here, because a lot of the grown-up sharing on social media, particularly the sharing about one's children, tends to cross over the line into bragging pretty quickly. And we all have sort of different levels of taste and appreciation for that. So some of the experts I talked to suggested a different twist, right? What if it is the kids who are doing the sharing themselves? Middle school and high school kids have a certain amount of access to social media and the ability to share. So maybe if they talk about the giving they're doing, it will sound a little bit less like bragging and perhaps more like something that will inspire others to pipe in and say, yeah, you know, my family gave to this, or it'll give a third and a fourth child an idea or an opportunity to bring that up in conversation with their families themselves.
What is it they say? Attraction rather than promotion. Talk about what you're doing instead of bragging about it. That's Ron Lieber, author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. And we've been talking to him about his recent Your Money column in the New York Times, giving the gift of generosity to your kids by having them think about giving away. Ron, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And we mentioned the Brandeis School, where parents contribute to a pool money they would have spent on bat and bar mitzvah gifts. Then the kids interview charities over the year. In the spring, they'll decide how to give that money out. We will check in then. It is nearly impossible to spend a night on Nashville's Lower Broadway, that hub of honky-tonks, without seeing several groups of women celebrating an impending marriage. These bachelorette parties have become so synonymous with Nashville's tourism boom, they're an inside joke for locals. But for many business owners, the presence has a very real benefit. Emily Siner of Here and Now contributor WPLN has our story.
It's a Saturday night on Broadway in downtown Nashville, and Taylor Heltzley is brandishing a giant inflatable phallic object.
That's so funny.
Heltzley is getting married 4 weeks later, and she's with her friends visiting from Louisville. She chose Nashville because she knows people who came here for their bachelorette parties.
There was some other girls that have got married, like, in the past years, and they said they went, and it was, like, a blast, and they, like, catered to, like, bachelorettes and brides.
Down the block, in front of a row of honky-tonks, Kristen Quince heard the same thing.
Nashville's, like, the new Vegas.
Quince lives in Washington, D.C., but most of her party of 10 flew in from California.
Everyone wants to come here. I love country music, and so it was just like the perfect place to get everyone together.
It's where the party's at!
From Ohio, Vanessa Sharp and Brianna Desiree Southers are lingering outside of a bar wearing matching purple tops. Yeah. Can you tell me about the shirts that you made?
And then it's like for Lauren's bachelorette party.
But Lauren, it turns out, is no longer with the group.
We lost our bride.
She's in there somewhere.
What? Proof that in Nashville, you don't even need a bachelorette to keep the bachelorette party going. It's not clear exactly how or when the city started gaining this reputation. Nashville has successfully marketed itself as a hot tourism destination in recent years, especially as a hub for live country music. But it never officially marketed itself as Bachelorette Central. There's no one defining moment that set off the boom. And yet, the boom is unmistakable. There are so many brides-to-be on this quarter-mile stretch of downtown Nashville that I lose count within an hour.
There are literally four bachelorette parties on this street corner alone.
Wow. It's gotten wild. It's truly gotten wild.
That's Caroline Miller, a teacher who's lived in Nashville for 3 years. She says not everyone who lives here is enamored with the bachelorette phenomenon.
I think some people love it. I think other people are very annoyed by it. And they just think, why are these people invading our city? They're ruining Broadway.
Among those in the latter camp is Alex Covert. He's on the front lines as a bouncer at a popular honky-tonk called Layla's. Tonight, he's manning the hot dog stand outside.
They're usually really obnoxious. There's always one out of the group that cries. Every time.
I think we tend to go quick to, they're clogging my roads, or look at them acting silly. Well, they're on vacation.
Butch Spiridon is the guy in charge of Nashville's official tourism strategy. He says he knows locals get frustrated, especially when they're stuck behind one of those pedal taverns, a mobile bar that tourists ride on, or when they're living next door to an Airbnb that rotates through parties every weekend. But he says,
I'd say be nice to them. Your listeners, be nice to them. They're leaving a lot of money behind, and they really are harmless.
Yes, money. Nashville doesn't track the economic impact of bachelorette parties. But Spiridon says if he had to guess, as I asked him to, he'd say a fifth of Nashville's leisure tourism is related to bachelorettes. And they're the ideal tourists.
They're not scared of the hotel rates. They're not on a low budget. They are coming to celebrate.
In other words, behind all the matching outfits and inflatable phallic objects and other prenuptial silliness, there is serious business here. And the business ripples throughout the city, from hotels and restaurants to companies that exclusively plan bachelorette parties. Barrett Hobbs knows this firsthand. He owns a few honky-tonks downtown. One called Doc Holliday's is a small bar styled like a Western saloon.
I can remember standing out, and I looked down the street, and you could see literally thousands of people coming up and down the street, but there was one group you could identify. It was a bunch of girls with sashes on and funny hats and matching T-shirts or whatever their shtick is.
That was about 4 years ago, he says. Fast forward, and the business stream is consistent and lucrative.
You know, on a given Saturday night, we may have at one of our properties 15 different bachelorette parties come through. So if you add that up, seven nights a week times all of the merchants in downtown, it's, you know, thousands is an understatement.
Hobbs says bachelorettes make for good customers. They don't start fights. They spend a lot of money. And if locals are annoyed, well, there are plenty of bachelorette-free places to hang out in the city, just not on a Saturday night on Broadway. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Seiner in Nashville.
Well, what I'm hearing there is that, ladies, wacky bachelorette parties are almost your responsibility. They are good for the economy.